Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. It's almost over, or it's just beginning, depending on how you look at it. Tomorrow, the rest of us head to polls. 41 million of us have already cast our ballots in early voting. Today, we're considering the two constitutional amendments you'll find on the ballot, and we'll talk with the head of the Virginia Department of Elections. A little later, we'll meet Patricia Harrison, the president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. She was in town last week. And 2 weeks ago, ABC News correspondent Bob Woodruff was here promoting his new documentary about military medicine. It's a jam-packed show, and we'll get to it right after this news from NPR. We're at 6 minutes past the hour. Great to have you with us on a pre-election day Monday in Hampton Roads. I promise you, on Wednesday, you got to give me 1 week before anybody mentions 2020, or it's going to get real up in here. I just need a rest from this thing. I think we all do, don't we? There are two constitutional amendments on your ballot tomorrow. One has to do with unions. The other has to do with tax relief for the spouses of first responders killed in the line of duty. Professor Quentin Kidd will join us in just a few minutes to walk through those two questions. The other thing we wanted to talk about today has to do with gambling on the presidential election. Professor Josh Zinger is with us from Old Dominion University today. He's in the political science and geography department. And nice to have you with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So this is something Americans love to gamble, don't they?
Americans do love to gamble.
They
people
sure
around
do.
The world love to gamble on our elections, as a
yeah,
matter of fact.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Can we gamble on our elections?
Americans, technically not legal to gamble on American elections. However, if you're interested, plenty of overseas bookmakers, odds makers will be taking bets on who is likely to win the
wow.
presidential election and all sorts of other things involving our politics.
So that's very interesting because it makes you wonder whether they're genuinely interested in our politics or whether they're genuinely interested in beating the odds.
Oh, I mean, people are interested in making money, but yeah. I've talked to a bookmaker from the UK and he says, our system is perfectly set up for betting. You have two candidates. There's going to be a clear winner. Unlike a lot of European politics where there's multiple parties,
interesting.
There's coalitions to see who picks the prime minister. So you're not voting for the chief executive directly. And the American case, our system is bet up.
Clear and compelling.
Yeah. I mean, if you think of the horse race narrative that yes. we've gotten for the last, really since the summer, is set up who's ahead, by how much, what are the odds.
And the third parties don't really figure into that scenario, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, there's no serious third-party effort in the United States right now. It looks Gary Johnson is, I'm sure, not going to crack 5% of the vote tomorrow. So, yeah, no threat of them winning. It's down to two candidates, and the question is, who and by how much?
All right. Well, who and by how much? What do the odds look like right now?
Well, the bettors are relatively bullish on Clinton's chances, and this is especially so since the FBI announced there was no new information contained in the emails seized in Anthony Weiner's computer. Certainly, I did not think I'd be saying that name a day before the election, but Hillary Clinton stands somewhere around a 5-to-1 favor, or bettors are giving her roughly an 83% chance to win.
And what goes into their thinking on that? Because they have pretty accurately predicted the result in past elections.
So I think the biggest thing is people's bets are informed by the polls, and certainly the polls as a group, not I'm guessing most people betting on elections, pay attention to a lot of polls and make a decision based on the aggregate, but also place bets at least on information that's not contained on polls. And this is where I think the interesting part of betting, or why it can be revealing, looking at gambling markets. And you think in late September, when the markets or the polls were moving in favor of Trump, bettors were still more skeptical. And you ask yourself, why would they be more skeptical of Trump's chances? Well, there's always the perception that Trump was somewhat of a wild card, or might say or do or have something revealed about him that would hurt his chances. And then the first debate and the various videotapes that have emerged with Trump have moved the polls back closer to the better as opposed to the other way around. So here the bettors were anticipating Trump doing or saying something that might hurt his chances. And I think those perceptions largely have come to fruition.
We're 10 minutes past the hour talking with Professor Josh Zinger. You know, one of the other things, you're an observer of voter behavior. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, as you have looked at this election, we are anecdotally hearing from people who say, I am really concerned about safety at the polls. We know there was a report locally of at least one set of canvassers who were canvassing for a candidate, and they were followed by someone who had a visible gun, which is, by the way, legal, but they felt sort of intimidated by that. And I wonder, as you look at election behavior, is this any worse in that regard than it has been in past elections?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on how far back you want to go. You think pre-Voting Rights Act in the South, in Norfolk, Virginia, where we're sitting, the type of voter intimidation is nowhere near, or voters efforts at voter suppression is nowhere near what we saw 50 years ago, in terms of where we essentially had an apartheid system banning African Americans from voting in many states in the South. Now I would say most of these efforts at suppression or intimidation are really around the fringes. Maybe we've seen more in this election than is typical. Mm-hmm. But I think this is it's an attractive news story. But this is not something I would anticipate really determining the outcome.
You feel as, maybe you have absentee voted, but you feel going to the polls tomorrow, you will be have no problems.
That would be my suspicion, although I should note that this is coming from the perspective of a white male voting in a largely upscale white precinct. So my experience certainly is not universally shared. But on the balance, I don't think this is going to be an issue.
We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Wondering how you're feeling about going to the polls tomorrow. Give us a call. You can also check us out on our Facebook page, where we're talking about that as well. I have to say, I posted this earlier on our Facebook page. I was very surprised by this. I don't think this is normal, but you know, who knows? Maybe it is. Friend of mine, college friend, is a videographer for one of the major networks, and they have issued them Kevlar vests and helmets for the election because of the verbal threats against journalists. It's an interesting thing.
Well, I mean, interesting is one way to put it. As someone that comments on elections publicly, it's a little can be a little frightening. I will say that thus far, we haven't really seen a whole lot of evidence that the rhetoric is going to be backed up by actions, and certainly, obviously, hopefully it won't. But to this point,
let us hope, right? Yeah. 13 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Wondering how you're feeling about going to the polls tomorrow. Let's go to Ryan on the line. Hang on. We're going to hold on, Ryan, just for a second. We're at 14 minutes past the hour. And in a few moments, we're going to be talking with Dr. Quentin Kidd from the Judy Ford Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport. A little later, we'll talk with Commissioner Edgardo Cortez with the Virginia Department of Elections. And we'll also talk with Pat Harrison, the President and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and Bob Woodruff with ABC News. Let's see. We've got a question from Kevin, who wants to know about the effect of leaving your presidential choice blank on the ballot. Would that invalidate the ballot? I don't know that you know the answer to that
absolutely.
Question.
But you are under no compulsion to vote for all offices on your ballot. You can vote for one out of however many choices you're presented, or all but one, or all of them. No, you're under, it's your constitutional right to vote for as many or as few candidates as you want.
And your vote in where you have voted will still count.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, thanks for that. Ryan's on the line from Portsmouth. Hi, Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi there, thanks for taking my call. I'm 31 years old, and because of trouble that I got in when I was younger, I've never voted.
Really?
Governor McAuliffe was kind enough to restore my rights for me, and this will be my first election. And I just wanted to make it clear to people that, you know, there's a lot of excuses going around. My vote doesn't count, or, you know, I'm just a small fish in a big pond, or, you know, it doesn't matter because neither one of them is a good choice. No, every single person has a voice to count. And I'm excited about going, and I encourage everybody to get out there, especially on the local level. I've been in Portsmouth all my life, and we've got some real problems there, mm-hmm. but nothing is ever going to change if everybody thinks my voice doesn't count. And
wow.
That's basically all I had to say.
Ryan, you should do a PSA. That was very impressive. I congratulate you on getting your voter rights restored. It's the fundamental right of citizens. And so I'm really going to be thinking about you at the polls tomorrow for your first voting experience. Well done. And you will have an opportunity. You have a big old ballot in Portsmouth. I think you have a whole lot of mayoral candidates on the ballot. So you've got a lot to vote for tomorrow in Portsmouth. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care. 16 minutes past the hour. Dr. Quentin Kidd with us now, director of the Judy Ford Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University. Quentin, we're almost there.
I'm just I don't even know what to say. I'm ready for this to be over.
I know, but as I said earlier in the program, nobody can mention 2020 for at least 7 days. Question for you on these amendments. We've got two constitutional amendments on the ballot. The second one asks whether you are okay with tax exemptions for the spouses of first responders killed in the line of duty. That has to do with real estate taxes. That one is probably pretty self-explanatory. This amendment number one, though, is causing a lot of confusion because of the way that it's written. So I wonder if you would break it down for us. It has to do with what we call in Virginia the right to work, and that is a phrase around unions.
That's right. In fact, it's a counterintuitive phrase. The right to work means prohibits a unionized shop from requiring another worker in that shop who doesn't want to be in the union to be in the union as a condition to work at that shop. And so right to work, a lot of people who support unions don't like that term right to work, but that's the term being used. Really, what this is doing is it's taking what is current Virginia law, which is this right to work law, and putting it into the Constitution, really word for word. And it's been in Virginia law since 1947. So since 1947, Virginia has been a quote-unquote right-to-work state. And in recent years, as Virginia began to change politically, some Republicans decided, you know, there'll be a day in the future where Virginia has a legislature that's controlled by Democrats and perhaps a Democratic governor, and that legislature and governor may want to change the law and make unions stronger in Virginia. And so in order to keep that from happening, the proposal is to move that law into the Constitution, because it's much harder to change the Constitution than it is to change the law.
Interesting. So is it too simplistic then to say that, that if you support unions, you're likely to vote no on this one, and if you don't support unions, you're probably likely to vote yes?
I think that's a very accurate way to describe it. However, we know that most people don't make it to the bottom of the ballot with these kinds of elections. People turn out to vote in a presidential election, and they may have a lot of other elections on their ballot, depending on what locality they live in, and they may not make it to the bottom of the ballot, which is where these two questions are going to be. And so what we see is massive voter drop-off. So the number of people who vote for the presidential election compared to the number of people who will vote in these ballots is probably one-half to two-thirds.
Wow. Wow.
So you've really got to be an adroit voter to make it all the way to the bottom of the ballot, or you have to really be concerned about one of these two questions. And I think the one that's going to draw most attention is this question number one, the right to work question.
Yeah. How do you feel as a political science professional about these kinds of efforts where we seek a constitutional amendment to do something that we already have a law around? In other words, I guess, what do you see as what's appropriate to deal with in the Constitution and what's not?
Well, I think for the most part, limited government people would say that this is not the right thing to do, that we shouldn't legislate through the Constitution. That we should legislate through legislation, and the Constitution should be the place where broad principles are laid out. Now, somebody who supports this would say it is a broad principle being laid out. It's a broad principle against unions. There are people who argue both ways. I think, generally speaking, Constitution should lay out broad principles and then let legislators enact laws to articulate the fine details of those broad principles. And that's what has been done here, again, for half a century since 1947. That's the way this has worked. It's only now that legislators are saying, well, maybe we should put this in the Constitution because we may not always be here to protect it.
Got about 30 seconds left with you, Quentin Kidd. What are you going to be looking for tomorrow night? What do you think? What kinds of trends are you going to be looking for?
I'm going to be looking for margins in Chesterfield County. If Trump's margin is greater than 15,000 votes out of Chesterfield, he's going to have a better night than a lot of people are thinking. I'm going to be looking at total turnout in the six core cities of Virginia, Richmond, Norfolk, Portsmouth, Newburgh, New Hampton. It'll say something about African-American enthusiasm for Clinton. And then Loudoun, Manassas City, and Prince William County, those are sort of ground zero for the Latino vote in Virginia. So I'm going to be looking at what those two places do.
Always good to talk with you, Quentin. Thanks so much for being
you
with
too.
Us.
Take care, Kathy.
Take care now. Bye-bye. I bet you that Quentin Kidd will be on Twitter at Quentin Kidd tomorrow night. Josh Zinger, thank you so much for being with us. Very quickly, in the 10 seconds we have left, 15 maybe, what are you going to be looking for tomorrow night?
I'm going to be looking at, like Quentin said, vote margins in some key states. And particularly, I'm going to be looking at Pennsylvania right off the bat. And I think looking at Pennsylvania will be a great bellwether. If Clinton wins Pennsylvania by double digits, it's over for Trump. If it's close, Trump's got a real shot going down to the other states. And if Trump wins, it's over for Clinton.
Wow. Josh Zinger, thank you so much for being with us today from Old Dominion University, talking to us about this betting that's going on around the presidential election, not in the United States, at least officially, but overseas. Lots of interest all over the world in the election that we will have tomorrow. Again, a reminder, check out that State Board of Elections website to find out where you're going to be voting and who is on your ballot. In fact, in just a few moments, we're going to be talking with Commissioner Edgardo Cortez about that very thing. Stay with us. It is going to be a very busy day tomorrow for Virginia's Commissioner of the Department of Elections and the Chief State Election Official for the Commonwealth. He is Commissioner Edgardo Cortez, and he joins us now. Thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. I wonder, what does your day look like tomorrow? I mean, it must start extraordinarily early.
We start pretty early. Most of our local officials start arriving at their polling places around 4:30 in the morning, and that's where we start then fielding calls about any last-minute issues that people are having, things that we can assist with at the state level, and then get ready for the polls to open at 6 a.m.
And do they stay for the entire day, or do they come in shifts, or how does that work?
There are a couple places where they allow shifts, but most of them are there all day long. So
they
arrive around 4:30 in the morning, and then the polls close at 7, and it's usually a couple hours after that till they finish up. So it's a very long day for our volunteers.
Sure.
Tomorrow.
And so for their 18 hours a day, they are paid so very richly, right?
That's right. It's a very small amount.
Yeah.
We really do consider it volunteer. We really appreciate it. I mean, we have over 10,000 election officers in the state that will be working the polls tomorrow. And so there's a lot of people out there, a lot of voters that give up their time to help make sure the process goes smoothly.
Yeah, I talked to one of my neighbors who has been a head of the polling place for 27 years. And she said that at the age of 75, this is going to be her last one. But she has really, really enjoyed it. And I've never talked to anybody who's done that job that hasn't felt that it was a great public service and something that they really felt very privileged to do. So I guess if people want to do it for the next election, they should talk to their local boards of elections and find out what the training process is.
Oh, they absolutely should. We always encourage people to sign up and to serve as election officers. It really is a rewarding experience, and it's a big help to your neighbors with you being there and making sure that things are running the way they should on election day, making sure that it's a real open and transparent process and everybody has a role in it.
So speaking of open and transparent and making sure that everybody does what they're going to do, we have heard in recent days there was the call out to an organization of folks to go to the polls and sort of stand by and watch vigilantly with weaponry visible, should that be a legal circumstance for them. And I guess I wonder about that. What are you hearing in terms of who may be at the polls watching either in an official or an unofficial capacity? And what are your rules around that?
Sure. Well, officially, there's a very limited number of people that are allowed inside the polling place. So we have the election officers we just talked about, the voters, of course, and then all of the parties and the independent candidates are all allowed to have representatives there at the polls. And they're really watching the process. They're there throughout the entire day. They can see and hear everything that's going on, you know, to make sure things are going as they're supposed to. So we do have people that observe the process. And we have very, you know, specific law set out and policies and procedures set out to make sure they're not interrupting the process, but they are able to see everything that's going on. When it comes to people outside the polling place, we do have a 40-foot perimeter outside the polling place where no electioneering or anything can take place. Outside of that, really, then it becomes a law enforcement issue. There's activity going on outside of that 40-foot boundary that is disruptive to voters coming in and coming in or out of the polling place. That really is something we would then refer to our local law enforcement partners.
Interesting. And we should note as well that if you have not voted in an election between the last presidential election and this one, then you will be greeted by a requirement for a photo ID. Do you feel like the word has pretty much gotten out on that? And what is an acceptable form of ID?
We certainly hope so. We've been doing the best we can here at the department. I know our local registrars have been doing a lot to make sure that voters are informed about what the acceptable forms of ID are, which include things like driver's licenses, passports, employer IDs, student IDs for colleges and universities located within the Commonwealth. So there's a whole host of acceptable forms of ID, and we want everybody to know that if they don't have one of those acceptable forms, they can go to their registrar's office and request a free ID in order to cast their ballot. So it's a, you know, we have really focused on making sure that that requirement does not hinder anybody from exercising their right to vote.
And you can even do that tomorrow, I understand. Go to get your photo ID and then head to the polls.
You absolutely can do that tomorrow, and for those voters that end up in a situation where they maybe didn't know about the requirement before Election Day or they lost their ID or something, they will be issued a provisional ballot, and they'll have until next Monday at noon to go to either locate their ID if they lost it or go to the registrar's office on these next couple days and obtain one of those free IDs.
Sure. Absentee ballots, what is that process? And I guess if you want to vote absentee early, you are out of luck at this point.
Yeah, so our in-person absentee voting ended on Saturday. Saturday was the last day. We have blown through records this year, both in terms of registration, but also absentee. We closed out Saturday with a little over 615,000 absentee applications being approved. Around 350,000 of those were in-person votes, and the rest of them are people that were mailed ballots. So we've had a lot of participation, a lot of activity during the absentee voting period.
Wow. And when do you open those ballots and count those?
So they will, on Election Day, tomorrow, they will start processing and taking care of those absentees. So they'll tally them up on Election Night, just like all the other votes.
And, I think all of us hope this certainly does not happen. If you got to the polling place and there were some difficulty with your ballot and you were concerned about it, is there a process by which one can be in touch with your office to let them know about that?
Sure. So we have a so the department people can go to vote.virginia.gov, and there's an online complaint form there where it goes to us and to the local election official where they're from. So that is certainly that's certainly one option that's available to people, and is probably the easiest for folks because that asks you all the questions about what precisely happened, who where you were voting, what time of day it was. all of that. People can also give us a call at 1-800-552-9745, and that's toll-free, and we'll take all that information over the phone as well. But those are two options. But if people are experiencing a problem at their polling place, we always encourage people to bring it to the election officer's attention while they're there, because if it's something that's impacting their ability to cast a ballot, they should let the election officers know right away before they cast that ballot so they can resolve the issue.
Commissioner Cortez, we have been asking people to check out elections.virginia.gov and not only look at their ballot, but actually reconfirm where they're voting, because many, many people in our region will be voting at different places as a result of redistricting and some other developments. And I wonder, what kind of action are you seeing there at that site? Or do you think that message is getting through, that people really need to check that before they go?
Oh, I think so. And we always see a spike on election day in terms of people coming to look up their polling place. But yeah, vote.virginia.gov not only has the polling place info, but you can see what's on your ballot.
Yeah.
Not only do we have two state constitutional amendments on the ballot tomorrow, but we also have there's a lot of local races around the state, a lot of local referenda. And so that'll give voters an opportunity to see what's on their ballot, study it, and figure out so when they get in there, it's a smooth process.
Commissioner Edgardo Cortez, I wish you a nap this afternoon and a successful day tomorrow in your process of letting the citizens of Virginia cast their votes. Thank you so much for being with us from Richmond today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Commissioner Edgardo Cortez is the commissioner of the Virginia Department of Elections. He's also the chief state election official for the Commonwealth of Virginia. And, of course, you can tune in to 89.5 WHRV-FM or WHRO-TV-15 for extensive election coverage. Much of the work of the public radio service and the public television service is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And we were very happy last week to sit down for an in-depth conversation with the president and CEO thereof, Patricia Harrison. We are so glad to welcome Pat Harrison to our program today. She's the president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Kathy.
Can you give us a sense, because I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand, the connection of CPB, NPR, PBS. Can you draw that diagram for us?
We have a lot of initials in public
media,
but the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, we serve as the steward of the federal appropriation. Congress appropriates these monies, and according to a very strict formula, we distribute them to America's public television and radio stations. And I like to refer to it as a virtuous circle, because the funding is a foundation, which means that once the stations receive the monies, which are very, very important and provide that foundation, they then have to go out into the community, almost get a financial report card. The community supports the station because the station is delivering goods and services, content and services important to the community. Then the community communicates this back to Congress.
Right.
And Congress then understands that this is of value to the American people and funds the appropriation.
A virtuous circle. I like that. So one of the conversations we're having all across the country, as you know, has to do with local journalism. And boy, there could not be a better time to be having that conversation when we look at what's happening in the print business, which is sort of the place we would go for excellent, in-depth local journalism all across the country. That model's certainly changing. As you think about investments in local journalism, how do you see those taking shape? Because I know CPB has been really interested in that and funding a lot of it.
Yes, about 7 years ago, we watched as newspapers were declining, and what was very much of concern, a lot of things were of concern, but was a lack then of the diminishment of covering local news, so very important to a healthy civil society. So we put aside funding to create local journalism collaborations that have now turned into regional journalism collaborations, and public media, radio, and television stations working together on issues of concern, covering local issues. But as you know, Kathy, many times these local issues are a national concern
Absolutely.
As well. And working with NPR and working with PBS NewsHour, frequently these local issues become magnified on the national stage and sometimes globally as well. So we are committed. Education and journalism, those are the two core pillars of public media.
Yeah, and it makes sense. You mentioned civil society, and that is something we are very, very committed to on this broadcast, have so been for 20 years now. But one of the things that we have noted is the general decline in civil discourse, certainly in other parts of the radio dial and on television. So it's something we feel very strongly about here. But I think it's really something that people are beginning to value, particularly in this very brittle presidential process we find ourselves
in. It's so important. And we like to say, because it's our mission, that the work that we do strengthens our civil society. And when that society becomes fragmented, fragmentation doesn't mean disagreement. Mm-hmm. And we always say in public media, we provide a safe place to debate. And that's why John McCain, in his only debate with his Democratic opponent, the two of them decided that they were going to go to public media, not to commercial media. Why did they do this? Arizona PBS and then the public radio station. Because they knew they'd have a moderator that had just one goal, one agenda, and that was to get these two candidates to answer the questions in a factual way so voters can make their decision one way or the other.
Right.
So if we are missing that in our society, then we're not informed. You want to be informed so you can make choices, so that when you listen to someone, you have a base of information and you can say, you know, that mm-hmm. doesn't sound right. Let me go further. Let me do a deep dive. So with public radio, what WHRO is doing, it is presenting information that's far more than just a soundbite. We cannot live by soundbites alone.
Boy, isn't that the truth?
And
isn't that the truth?
It doesn't enhance us. And it's not just in a political environment. We want to be good parents. We want to be good citizens. We want to know as much as we can. We're looking at huge issues, whether it's health, whether it's environment, whether it's when to retire,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
So you want to be able to trust the information source.
You know, it's really interesting you talk about sound bites. I've always believed that in conversation, people will reveal themselves for good or ill. They will reveal the truth of who they are if you
Well,
talk
I'll
with
tell
them.
You, if, you know, for all of my voice lessons, after a while, you know I come from Brooklyn, New York.
So. I picked up on that.
So, where, as I like to say, conversation is talking and waiting to talk. But, so try to get a word in edgewise.
That's great. That's a great definition. Boy, but you know, it's really true. We have these challenges that are complex and expensive, difficult. And if we don't find a way to talk about them, and I think we've really noticed that in this presidential campaign more than any other. I was watching one of the debates, and it was on one of the commercial stations. It was a very intriguing moment. It's actually during the primaries. Mm-hmm. And there was an argument, one of these we're all talking at the same time moments, that was allowed to go on for quite a long time. And I found myself thinking, hold up, where's the moderator in this? And one of the other candidates had to say the person's mm-hmm. name. You need to jump in here. And that's when the light bulb went off for me. And I thought, oh, okay. A piece of this may have to do with what the profit motivation is here.
You think?
Okay. I'm slow. I admit that. That's why I've been trying to do this for 20 years. I'm still trying to get it right. But that, I thought that was real. I was like, oh, okay.
Yes.
That's going to be the bite. That's going to be on the news the next day. So if you let it go on, I'm not trying to cast aspersions. It was just that moment where you went, oh, that's why that's happening.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen in public broadcasting.
It doesn't. And I think in terms of public broadcasting, we are really concerned about keeping that trust that the public invests in us, to not take it for granted, to do our homework, to present the facts. And I am concerned as well, because as we have benefited from the democratization of technology, there's a lot of stuff flying back and forth that goes viral very quickly. And unless you have a base of knowledge, just to say, can this be true, as opposed to, hey, this is true, we have to be educated as citizens. And our education has to go beyond formal school. It has to be what is good. And, you know, you can think of it in a selfish way, because when we talk about our civil society, it almost sounds like something out of a history class. It's not immediately. What difference does that make to me as I go to work every single day? I have to make a living for my family. It affects your entire family, the society in which they live. Is it going to be positive? Is it going to be a hair trigger society? Is it going to be one where we listen? Could disagree, always disagree, but disagree with respect and with the facts that you have.
I know you're in town to be at an event with some of our donors here at WHRO, and I know you're going to enjoy meeting them. But I know that one of the larger issues you have to be looking at, because everybody is future funding sources. And I wonder, as you think about that, where do you see additional funding opportunities?
Well, first, I think that the creators of the Public Broadcasting Act, which is now 50 years old, were prescient in so many ways, because unlike any other country on the face of the earth, and we complain about this sometimes too, Americans spend under $1.30 of their taxpayer dollars for public media. In Great Britain, it's, 20, 30 times that amount. In most countries, you're taxed quite a bit. And the reason they did that is because we are a country of volunteers. That's our DNA. So the idea was, we value public media. Let us give you this foundational funding. And as I said before about the virtuous circle, let's have the American people support this wonderful thing of value. At the same time, as we take on a lot of issues, and as we do not want commercials, we like to say it's a safe place, commercial-free, where children can learn, we do need to be supported. We don't want support that has any strings attached to it, because that would undermine the trust people have in us when we're reporting. But we can work in partnership, as we have, for example, through the American Graduate Initiative, everybody working together to help American kids graduate from high school and stop that horrible 1 million children a year failing to graduate, which I'm happy to say, after 5 years and stations like WHRO working on this, we have the highest high school graduation rate, 83% in this country, than we've ever had, and the work has just begun. I think the more we work with various nonprofits and foundations, no one can do the job we need to do. I call it the civil society job. We have to pull together.
Such a pleasure to talk with you. Welcome to Hampton Roads. Welcome back to Hampton Roads, I should say, because I know you've been with us before. Pat Harrison, the president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. One of the projects that has been funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is a documentary called Military Medicine, Beyond the Battlefield. It is featuring ABC News correspondent Bob Woodruff, who, as you will very likely remember, was very critically injured in Iraq when he was covering the war for ABC. He chronicled his recovery from a traumatic brain injury and has really devoted much of his life to looking after this process of military medicine. So that very fine documentary will air on November 9th at 10 o'clock on WHRO TV 15. While he was here talking about that documentary, we had a chance to sit down and talk with him about some of his experiences. Bob Woodruff, it's so nice to meet you. Thank you for being with us here in Hampton Roads.
It's great to be here, Kathy.
We're delighted to welcome you, and we're delighted to welcome Sally Garner, who is the writer and producer of this tremendous project on military medicine. Nice to see you, Sally.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. This project is something that is going to be important to the entire country, but is particularly important in a community like this one that is so heavily military-oriented. One in every two of our dollars is generated by the federal government, and of those folks who are in the military, we have about 40% of them walking around in a uniform. And I know, Bob, that's something that's really important to you with the work of the foundation and all of your life experience.
First of all, I forgot my uniform because I don't have one in the civilian world. But yeah, this is an important thing. That the topic of this hour is about medicine. And you know, in these wars of Iraq and Afghanistan, we've learned so much about medicine, one that's not spoken about all that much, not that often. But certainly those that are in the world that have been impacted by the wars and have something, whether visible or invisible, they understand and grateful for what's been done in medicine.
That visible-invisible piece is really so key to this whole conversation, because there are visible wounds and there's certainly been advances in medicine that have taken care of those better than they have been in past conflicts, but there are all of these invisible wounds as well, and that's what we're learning so much about.
Yeah, you know, if you look at the severe wounds that happened in the war, the ones that you can see are relatively small numbers percentage-wise. The ones that are invisible are much larger, and sometimes it's hard to identify, you know, who's suffering from and who's not. I think there was an assumption in the beginning, when we start to learn about this, in the beginning of Iraq and Afghanistan, there were a lot of stigmas attached to talking about an invisible wound. If you've lost a limb, or you're blind, or you're burnt, whatever it may be, everyone knows what happened. But people did not want to admit much about issues that make them not the same that they were before.
Sure.
And they have to separate themselves away. So yeah, so the invisible wounds are becoming more and more important in terms of dealing with the wounds from these wars.
Yeah. Sally, on those invisible wounds, and Bob talks about the stigma, which we're very familiar with in this community, how hard was it to find people who were willing to talk about those kinds of wounds?
You know, it's interesting. People were very willing to talk to us. I think that this generation of veterans, and Bob has talked about this a lot, they seem to be aware that it's important to talk about who they are, what they need, what they've learned from previous generations of veterans. When it comes to the invisible wounds, we interviewed a young woman who had a traumatic brain injury, Alana Duffy, and it was interesting because when she was injured in Iraq in 2005, she kept all her symptoms a secret. Mm. Her convoy was hit by an IED. She hit her head very badly. She was knocked out. She had blurry vision. She had memory loss. And she says that the reason she didn't say anything about it for several years was because she was afraid that they would think there was something wrong with her, that she had post-traumatic stress. She said all they were talking about was post-traumatic stress, and she was afraid of that. Eventually, she got treated for a traumatic brain injury, and they found a physical injury to her brain, and she's recovering, and she's really quite remarkable. You'll meet her in the documentary.
I think the percentages early on, that stigma was 90%, that people did not admit it. And then it's probably about 50 now, and it's still a high number. People just don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you talk about what we've learned from military medicine in these wars. It strikes me there are really some courageous stories in along the way. Military doctors and others who've said, look, we have to do something different because this is a different result. When you've got so many people, if you can make it to a hospital, you're very likely to survive. That's a very different kind of conflict.
Yeah, it's a different conflict. Because the wounds are so much different, the injuries are so much different than were in previous wars. I mean, when you go to Vietnam, for example, certainly World War II, World War I, you were either killed or not killed, killed or not touched in many ways. You were hit by that bomb and dead, or hit by the bullet and dead. It wasn't the kind of medicine to save your lives so easily. They were, absolutely they were. But even part of the piece is just the changes in tourniquets. Yes. In the old days, in the tourniquet, you just put it on here with a stick and just twisted, and now you got much more advanced simple things like tourniquets that can change lives. So they've changed it.
Yeah.
And the number of those who are wounded that would have been dead in previous wars include me. Mm. I've been told many times that if I was hit 5 years before I was hit, even a couple years before I was hit, that I would not be alive.
Wow. So in your own case, what were some of the lessons learned that were put to use in your own circumstance? Because you were very, very seriously injured.
Many. Mm. You know, stopping the bleeding. And now this was, it was not a tourniquet in my case, but it was those who'd been trained. You know, every single soldier that were with us, they had been taught how to stop the bleeding. You know, and the people assume it's a medic.
Right.
That does that. But everybody's got a bag on the side of their leg where they can do all of this. That's one simple change. They had them to a large degree in previous wars as well, that everybody could do something to save lives, but they're well trained for it. And then transportation was the other one, transport. I mean, to get us out of a place where there was a bomb with helicopters is so much more advanced to get you out quickly. And the wars were going for a long time in one particular place, so they were get very good at it. I would say the third would be the SeaCats that when you leave, like Landstuhl, for example, where all the wounded go, as the place between where they were hit and then the U.S. health areas where they went, where they end up, there is the air transportation that way that absorbed the bouncing around.
I think the
average was back in Vietnam was about 45 days average.
It was 45 days to an advanced care U.S. hospital.
Wow.
So you might have maybe gotten out of Vietnam to a combat field hospital. You might have been evacuated. But to get all the way back to the advanced care in a U.S. hospital is 45 days. In these wars, it's down to 4 days. And in Bob's case, it was 3 days.
Yeah. Wow.
It was 72 hours. And if this was 25 years ago, I would have been there for weeks, if not months.
Mm. So the quality of care is so extraordinary. And in the film, you see, and that was an important part of why we went to Germany, went to Rammstein, was to see these critical care air transport teams. And they're flying ICUs. I mean, you get onto the plane, and I think it's really quite extraordinary. I know it was for Bob, who kept saying, is this how I was transported? They look like hospitals.
I was in a coma. So
right. No memory.
Yeah. Let's go back there for the first time. But
it was amazing to watch them load the patients on and to see the level of medical technology that's inside a C-17 that's transporting you. And they deploy, now we're not at the same level of war as we were, but those C-17s, those ICU, flying ICUs, SeaCat teams will deploy for one person. If there's a service member anywhere in that theater that's in need of that kind of evacuation, they'll go. And they'll go get them and bring them to Germany and get them home.
We're aware, too, that a lot of what has been learned in military medicine has been adapted and implemented in the civilian sector, too, particularly around head injuries.
Well, that's, you know, we talked about that, too. It was pretty shocked when I came back and started doing reporting again about a year after I was hit. I remember seeing studies being done, not just by the military, but in cooperation with the NFL.
Yeah.
You know, things that we didn't even think about much before we saw so many TBIs, you know, traumatic brain injuries. So we are now seeing the U.S. military doctors, nurses, cooperating with the civilian doctors and nurses and research that never happened before. There's not that huge line now between medicine and those two worlds. But it's still there. There's no question about it. But that's being changed over time.
Bob, it strikes me that this is a great story to tell without doubt. But it strikes me that your experience lends something different to it than it might if someone were telling the story who hadn't had the experiences that you've had of military medicine and of being right on the front lines and experiencing the kinds of injuries that you experience. I wonder, do you think that had an influence in the way you told this story? I mean, what do you know because of your experience that...
I mean, because for covering, covering wars?
Yeah.
For being wounded myself?
From being wounded yourself to covering this story.
Both of them bring me closer together with the military. Mm-hmm. Than any of us had before.
Right.
You know, I did. That was the seventh time in Iraq when I was hit. So I'd been embedded twice, once with the Marines on the way in to Iraq from Kuwait, and then of course with the Army on this incident when this happened with me. So I had a lot of experience with the military anyway, you know, covering them.
Yeah.
And then to be in the same hospital with them for so long, and in terms of rehabilitation together with the same group of people, and then focusing a lot of my reporting on the veterans, which have been the bulk of it, really, in the last 9 years. I was hit almost just slightly more than 10 years ago.
Right.
So within that time, so really 10 years I've been reporting about that, so I know a lot about it, and have
and
a great
you,
relationship.
And you and your wife, Lee, wrote a wonderful book about this experience and what you learn on the other side of that, which is also about 9 or 10 years old. I wonder if you were to update that book in any way, and that's not a suggestion you should, by the way, I'm just wondering about that. What would be different now if you wrote that book today? I mean, what has changed since the publication of that book in terms of your lives?
A lot has changed. It's, you know, you can never put it, I think you asked me sometime when we spoke here today, mm-hmm. that about a percentage, you know, am I 90% closer to the way I was before? Am I the same, much worse? I mean, those percentages are going up every year, and yeah. it still is happening. You know, I still have a lot of issues with it. I have a loss of some memories. I have difficulties with words because I was hit on the left part of my head, and that's where the speech is in your brain. So I lost that. So I didn't lose the ability to comprehend or to make my point, but I have to look around for different words to replace the ones I used to know, but now I've forgotten. And names are difficult because there's no synonym for a name. You know, you can't remember that one. You can't come up with another one.
Right.
So we can do it with a language.
Yeah.
But that's really the promise. And that's never going to go back to normal.
Yeah. So this idea, the implications of just being near bomb blasts and the whole stand down process, all of that came out of these conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. I want to thank you both for joining us. What a fascinating conversation. Congratulations on the foundation and the work that you're doing, Bob. And Sally, I hope you get a lot more funding to do what you do and to tell these magnificent
She's
stories.
She's a great producer, I have to say.
I can see that.
He makes my life easy.
Experience.
He makes my life easy. Kathy, thank you so much. Uh-huh. It's a privilege to
thank
be here.
You,
thank you.
Finally today, a reminder that the polls open at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning and will remain open until 7 o'clock. You will need a photo ID at the polls. And if you are curious about where you're voting, and many of you are voting in different places than you have before, you will want to check out elections.virginia.gov. And that's also where you can look at a sample ballot and see what questions and candidates will be facing you when you show up at the polls. We also want to hear from you about your experience at the polls tomorrow. So be sure to log on to our Facebook page and let us know what's going on there. We're very interested in hearing what the atmosphere and the mood is at the polls in this particularly contentious election season. So we'd love to hear from you at our Facebook page or by email at hearsay@whrv.org. Up next here on 89.5, it's Making Contact. And then coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15 at 8 o'clock, it's the Antiques Roadshow celebrating Asian Pacific heritage. And then at 9, it's USO for the Troops. This is a documentary that looks at how the USO has lifted the spirits of American service personnel for more than 75 years. So that's coming up tonight at 9 on WHRO TV 15. Thanks so much for listening today. Let's make it a peaceful election day tomorrow, and we'll talk again at noon.